On this episode, we discuss Marmaduke, the other one.
What did we do to deserve this? Dear God, what did we do?
And welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
Oh, I'm Stuart Wellington.
I'm Elliot Kalin, here to bring you an episode during the spookiest part of the year, December, early December.
Ooh,
wait, I thought it was still November.
Ooh. We're recording this November right now, but it's going to be released in early December.
Okay, because I'm still nutting.
In case anyone didn't listen to the last episode, Stuart is still nonstop masturbating for nonstop nut November.
Stuart, this episode's
being released in Don't Speak December, the month dedicated to the No Doubt song Don't Speak.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, well, finally, the song's going to get some credit in addition to airplay, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Finally, yeah.
Okay, well, this is actually not a podcast about gross things like jism or...
Or Don't Speak, the hit song from No Doubt.
Yeah, I guess don't listen to the back catalog then.
this is about bad movies. A podcast where we watch a bad movie and then we talk about it. In this case...
why did we do that? Why did we give ourselves this premise?
I don't know. I mean, it's had its rewards. Let's not... pretend it hasn't, but several years on.
There's a time when a grown man finds himself shortly before his 41st birthday watching the Marmaduke animated film and wondering how is this possibly the best of all possible worlds?
Just like the Doughboys premise has ground them down physically, this has ground us down emotionally. Only consume garbage.
Which is also what the Doughboys is about.
This is not the Marmaduke starring the live action one, quote, live action with CGI animals starring
Owen
Wilson.
That dog was CGI?
Well, I guess this is also CGI, but it was a cartoonier CGI. But we did that one. You might remember, we already talked about Marmaduke starring Owen Wilson.
We did that back in 2013. That episode was almost 10 years ago. We watched the live action Marmaduke.
Don't go back and listen to that one.
I'm probably not. I mean, it's episode 131. So by that point, I feel like we were starting to become human beings.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But grew up a little bit.
And this is, as I said, I was keen on doing this so we complete the MCU, the Marmaduke cinematic universe.
The Marmaduke crap universe.
This one, I mean, you got to say though, this one makes the other one look like a work of genius.
Yes. Yeah, just looking when I was going to log this shit on Letterboxd, I saw the poster for the other one, which features Marmaduke wearing sunglasses, and I'm like, ugh, to have watched that movie instead.
Speaking of Letterboxd, I sent you a screenshot of the score, and out of like almost 2,000 reviews of this Netflix Marmaduke, the average score is 0.9. That's the average score.
Wow.
That is insane.
That means there's one score that says 10 stars perfect, and then almost 2,000 other scores that say negative 10.
What's the maximum star rating on Letterboxd, Dan?
5-star.
Five-star system.
So
I wonder how they hacked the
five.
System to do 10 stars.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They got hackers in their payroll. So do we need to talk about our history with Marmaduke?
I mean, Marmaduke, he's a big dog. That's the whole premise. He's a big dog.
Let me give you a little behind the scenes backstory of the Kalin household. My kids have lately been very nostalgic for when my older son Sammy guest starred on the Boss Baby episode. They've been wanting to listen to it a lot. So when I said I was doing Marmaduke, a kid's movie, they ostensibly... even though there's one joke about a man's wife hating him that was a little rough for a kid's movie. Sammy was like, I want to do that episode too. Explain to me, who's this Marmaduke guy? And I was like, well, he's a big dog. And they were like Clifford? I was like, not that big. He's just like a regular size large dog. And they're like, but how big is he? The size of a house? No, he's just like a dog. He's just a regular large dog. There's nothing. Yeah. He's not monstrously big. And so the phrase monstrously big became the way that we were describing things. And Sammy was like, oh, I thought he was going to be monstrously big. I was like, no, he's not monstrously big. He's just regular big. And long story short, I told Sammy if he did his chores, then he could watch the movie with me. He did not. And so he was unable to watch the movie. And while I stopped the movie. And I went to him and I said, Sammy, you should not watch this movie. I was like, this would be like if I poured garbage in your eyes and ears. Like, you're better off not watching this. But he kept wandering into the room where I was watching it to ask me questions about it. So now Sammy has this strange kind of fetishistic fixation on the Forbidden Marmaduke movie. I was trying to explain Marmaduke to them, and they couldn't understand the humor implicit in a slightly large dog getting in the way and being clumsy. And to be honest, guys, I can't.
I mean, I guess
at this point,
you know, this is in the tradition of sort of like soft observational, like down home humor. I guess, you know, it's not a strip. It's a one single panel comic, I guess. For
that's the fucking trick, man. Just do a single panel.
For owners
bang
of
that bitch
big
out,
dogs.
Take a nap.
Like other people who own large dogs and are like, think it's so hilarious their travails owning a big dog probably have a Marmaduke
fridge. This is a comic strip that's been going on for almost 70 years straight. It started in 1954. This comic is only a couple months younger than my mom. And yet it is somehow... It's made 70 years out of this dog's big and doesn't realize how big he is. Like,
yeah.
Is it the way that Funky Winkerbean lasted for a long time off of band teachers?
I think
just
so.
Just clipping out the marching band comic strips, putting them up on classroom walls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how Dilbert still survives despite the creator being a horrible human, because there are office workers out there in the world who need a calendar.
He's also
very
dumb.
A horrible person.
Oh, he's awful.
He's not just horrible. He's also an idiot.
No, he's also dumb. He's also dumb. Not since Johnny Hart stopped being an alcoholic and became religious has a comic strip that lost its humor and the guy behind it lost his
lovability.
Let's say mind. Yeah, lovability. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not since Johnny Hart started doing comics heavily implying that Christianity was the replacement for Judaism has a comic strip creator gone from hero to zero so fast.
All right,
okay, let's
get into Marvin.
Let's get into this movie. So of course,
before we get into it, I just want to ask, where's the Fred Bassett movie, huh? Where's that?
Yeah, where is Fred Bassett?
If we're doing unfunny comic strips about dogs,
Elliot, you're
Fred
the one
Bassett?
Living in fucking Hollyweird. Why don't you ask all your neighbors?
You're right. Physician, heal thyself. I should be out pitching this right now.
Yeah. So we got 5 production logos. That's a good sign, right, guys? 5 of them.
Always.
One of them is Netflix. Okay. So we get a little animated title
When one
sequence.
Of the production logos is a publisher, you know you're going to watch a good movie.
So we get a little bit of an animated title sequence. It's kind of like lightly animated, kind of in the spirit of like an 80s comedy. And there's a funky Marmaduke song that I think is a horrifying precursor of what's to come later on. It is foreshadowing. You're like, oh, a funky original Marmaduke song. What's this going to mean? Well, it foretells something even more horrifying.
Before we get too far in, I just want to say that one of the production companies is One Cool Animation, part of One Cool Group Limited. A production company whose first film in 2014 was Naked Ambition 2, which is it looks like it's a Hong Kong movie with a busty lady on the front. So that's like this production company seems to mostly specialize in non-animated films, to no one's surprise, based on the quality of the animation in this.
Interesting.
In this movie.
would it make you feel any better about it to know that this movie was directed by Merk Dippe, director of the live action Spawn from 1997?
No kidding.
Yeah, he directed the live action Spawn, and then also after that, mostly a bunch of straight to video animated things that look even worse than Marmaduke, if that's possible. But
yeah, I mean he's well involved with comic strip movies because he made Garfield Gets Real, Garfield's Fun Fest, and Garfield's Pet Force. Mm. So
after the opening credits, we do get the actual animation style of this movie. And how would you define that, Dan? Because you've already alluded it as, let's say, unappealing to the eye.
It is not as bad as Food Fight, but it looks like what I suspect Food Fight
the
looked
like. The faintest of praise. The faintest possible praise for animated film.
It looks like what I suspect Food Fight looked like before the hard drives were stolen. A lot of the assets in the background are clearly just like pre-made things that have been bought and like shuffled around, like trees place to place or a house. And everyone,
describe the character design for us. Yeah,
I would say that like most of the humans are blobs with like stick arms, and many of them have stick legs other than the mom, who is
fucking dragging a wagon, baby.
Anthony Lane broke into the into the design room being like, Elastigirl is not enough. Let's add some more junk to that trunk.
She looks like she's about to go on a girls' weekend to Miami, you know?
She also, I don't want to focus too much on this, but it is impossible to ignore. She's wearing these, like, terry cloth shorts that have more camel toe than I am comfortable with for a children's movie.
And if Dan's uncomfortable with it. Okay, well, great.
Well, they're really, like you said, they're really going for that positive Anthony Lane review.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Let's...
So you mentioned this funky Marmaduke song. Let's just say one thing. The soundtrack of this movie is not good, but it is working hard.
Yeah.
The soundtrack of this movie is constantly working so hard to suggest to you that this is the funky, fresh, cool for the 90s Marmaduke that we've all been waiting for.
Yeah,
it is,
with the voice of Pete Davidson as,
on the Marmaduke.
As Marmaduke. You know, everyone now, thought, like, who could capture Marmaduke? Only... the power of Pete Davidson, famous for dating people, as far as I've been able to discern.
Pete Davidson doing a voice performance that I would describe as, I would not know it was Pete Davidson unless his name was clearly listed in the credits. It's not necessarily a distinctive voice.
And only the minorest amount of shade being thrown here. But if I were to, I would just not assume that a professional actor did this performance.
No, I was surprised that the father... is played by David Koechner, like the head of the household, Marmaduke.
It's a heavily restrained performance by David
Koechner.
And
he does not sound like anything. He sounds like he just, you know, we joked about Eric Roberts recording from the bathtub. Like, I think these sound like voice memos he put on his phone.
Yeah. It's the weirdest thing is when you're watching a clearly kind of, I assume, low budget animated direct to Netflix movie. I think it was supposed to be released in theaters, but I don't know if it ever was. I guess there's a box office total on Wikipedia, so maybe it was. And the most energetic voice performance by a little bit is coming from J.K. Simmons as Zeus,
an
Academy Award winning actor who I don't know why he's involved in this at the moment.
He
you know,
the one person not entirely phoning it in.
Probably
it
money, or he likes Marmaduke a lot.
It was not.
He loves Marmaduke. Yeah.
It was not released theatrically in the U.S. It was released in other markets theatrically.
Okay.
So just to give a little bit of background.
Much the way the T-shirts for losing Super Bowl teams are sent to other countries to be worn by those who don't have enough first world rights.
Losing Marmaduke
to the winning league teams.
Film of the two Marmaduke films, and we're sitting there.
So a little bit of background. Yeah. Marmaduke is a Great Dane who is large and clumsy and poorly behaved, and he lives with a family whose name I do not remember, who are kind of fed up with him. They live
in the
suburbs.
They're the Winslow family.
And it's a suburban neighborhood that kind of looks like the suburbs level from Hitman 2 if you had to dial the like resolution down so that you didn't have a lot of lag in the game. So Marmaduke is not allowed to go to Billy, the son's birthday party, due to some past indiscretions that we are kind of lightly suggested. Something about a bone, et cetera. Marmaduke is trapped upstairs, and he has to watch all the kids have fun in the pool, and he gets to watch the father, Phil, cooking meat, which he describes as cooking my favorite, which is hilarious. It was a very good voice read.
Marmaduke is being treated as if like he's going to understand the cause and effect between like this punishment and previous problems that he's caused. And Marmaduke is a dog. Huh? Like he's being punished for doing
with the
dog
voice
things.
Of a man.
But he has, it's also never totally clear whether other characters can hear him talking, and he's a dog who learns martial arts.
It's
so
true.
I think they could legitimately expect him to understand consequences for his actions.
Could be
in this universe.
Now, Dan, you're our cartoon expert. Does Marmaduke normally talk in the comic strip?
No, Marmaduke is just a dog.
He is a force of nature. He's some kind of a natural constant.
Yeah, any talking is done about Marmaduke, not by Marmaduke.
So he's kind of like Godot, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. So Marmaduke gets distracted. He falls asleep on a bed. He has a weird dream. And then a bee attacks him, and it forces him to jump out the window, where he lands in a swimming pool, which causes a massive tsunami. Man, I just pulled a Marmaduke.
Yeah, boy.
It causes this massive tidal wave. that like drowns everybody at the party and floods the interior of their home.
They're like surfing on
it. It's amazing. It's amazing. Okay, so this is like a big inflatable pool at a party,
uh-huh.
roughly the size of a bounce house, let's say.
Yes.
And there's enough water in it to flood a town. It's crazy. Yeah, they're surfing on it. It's a huge wave that it takes cartoon physics and takes it into the realm of biblical miracles.
I am yes. so glad that you mentioned cartoon physics because I wanted to bring this up, Elliot, where like I'm a little dispirited by the fact that like Pixar, that, you know, a great company that's made many like masterpiece level cartoons. But like,
yeah, what are we going to have to disavow from what Dan's about to say?
I'm just like, their style has become largely, I mean, people are breaking out of it now. But for a long time, it was largely the default style for animation, and it has cartooniness in it, obviously, but it, you know, like the idea of like wacky cartoon physics kind of got eliminated because of how like computer animation works. It's hard to do the sort of distortions that, you know, you can do in 2D animation and make it look not horrifying, but like, you know, so I'm not against wacky cartoon
you're
physics.
Right, that a lot of CGI animation has become about how real can you make it look,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to how funny can you make it
exactly.
look.
Exactly. And so I would love more wacky cartoon physics, but the cartoon physics in Marmaduke bear like so little relation to how any two objects would interact that any possible comedy is smothered under like the weight of it.
I'm just glad I wasn't there when Isaac Newton was watching this movie, just like with his head in his hands being like, no, 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 no. That's I spent so much of my life understanding
head in his
the
hands
rules
because
of the universe.
He's torn his eyeballs out. Yeah.
He just pulled an apple from a tree and hit himself over the head with it until he was unconscious.
Exactly. Well, that rant was not as bad as I expected. I thought Dan was going to be like, I wish more movies were like Wicked City and shit. And I'm like, whoa, that's crazy,
what's Wicked
dude.
City?
even the kid movies?
Look this up.
So let's see. So footage of Marmaduke.
You haven't seen
Wicked
City, Dan?
So there's this spider lady, okay? And she is not a very good first date.
Okay.
just hit Wicked City GIF and you're going
to
get some
adding
good stuff.
Adding to watch list on Letterboxd.
So the footage of him falling out of the window goes viral and draws the attention of the world's greatest dog trainer, Guy, I think his name is.
I want to say it doesn't just draw the attention. This is a hilarious setup because like the newscast on the fact that this video has gone viral like starts out just as like a news report on this video, and then the news reporter is like, well, this dog is clearly untrainable. Even the world's greatest dog trainer who has retired from training dogs because there are no challenges couldn't do this. And the guy's sitting there watching it. And I kind of respected the movie for going that far in the fakeness of the setup.
That the news reporters are not just they're not just reporting on the news, but they are inciting and taunting real people challenges. To get the movie going. Welcome to INN, Inciting News Network, the news channel that makes movie plots happen.
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about Guy for a moment. Guy is set up as if he's going to be the villain of the movie,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he seems like he's scheming. He has some sort of – he's using Marmaduke for his own ends, and the movie seems to lose interest in that characterization of Guy fairly quickly.
And he also seems to be a match for Marmaduke. Like, when he first introduces himself to the family,
mm-hmm.
he shows that he is fast enough to keep Marmaduke from eating treats off of a plate. And he forces Marmaduke to do all this training. a lot of that training cuts into his time running around pretending to be a horse so that the son Billy can ride around and they can chase King Tut the cat, who is in the role of Black Bart, a outlaw.
Now that we brought up the cat, I just want to ask, like, mm-hmm. what's Marmaduke's relationship to the cat at the beginning of this movie? Because towards the end, the cat becomes an ally, and I was like, did I miss something where a change of heart occurred, or like, why?
Yeah, there's the cat. It's again, similarly, it seems like they're setting up a classic rivalry, dog and cat. But yeah, the cat turns out to be Marmaduke's biggest supporter and biggest champion, and in the end,
well,
spoiler alert, we'll get to it.
The cat later explains, Marmaduke would never do allow any harm to come to the family, which is kind of a wild thing to say.
Since Marmaduke's constantly harming the family yes. by accident.
And also, like, well, his powers ultimately are limited. Like, it's not like he can, like, prevent financial ruin or, like, some kind of horrible medical condition arise. Like, you never know.
The cat becomes an integral part of Marmaduke's later show-stopping dog show performance, as we'll see when we get to it.
A show-stopping performance that is never scored. They receive no scores whatsoever. I guess it just implied that it's perfection.
Yeah,
but at a certain point during that performance, we'll get to it, I guess, the cat is doing all the work, and Marmaduke is doing none of the work. Yeah. But anyway, this cat, I guess what you're saying, Dan, ultimately, is the character motivations and dynamics are a little mushy in Marmaduke.
So
this has real second draft problems in that I think there was no second draft of the script. it has real, we need to start making the movie in 4 hours energy. That's kind of what it's got.
Yeah, and very little narrative thrust, because there is a point, we'll get to it, like partway through the movie, where I'm like, I guess the main part of the movie is over and we're moving on to something else now. It turns out that's not true, but I felt that way for a second. Anyway.
Yeah, so the first day of training, where they're training out in the park, it basically devolves into this like martial arts battle where Marmaduke becomes obsessed with the promise of learning a magical kick technique from his trainer. Then we get like a montage where he's getting trained in posture, impulse control, and agility. And there, the montage involves him failing at all these things, but then all of a sudden he can just do them all.
Yeah. He gets whacked with a lot of tree branches along the way.
Including in the nuts, and he reacts particularly to that, here's the problem. If Marmaduke hasn't been fixed, not that I'm huge with taking body parts out of animals. That's not something I'm normally about. Unless the animal is dead, I'm going to eat that body part. But if you really want to control Marmaduke's energy, you gotta get him fixed. Come on, Winslows, this is on you.
That's the issue.
That Marmaduke is entering Pon Farr constantly and sure, just going yeah. and
he's,
just going wild.
He's entering Kemmer or something.
Yeah.
Okay. So at the completion of his training, he manages to earn his name back because his name was taken from him by his trainer at the beginning of their training. He was simply Dog. Now he has a name, Marmaduke.
Yeah, this is a real 9.5 weeks move on the part of the trainer to be like, you don't have a name anymore. You're just Dog. You'll get the name back when you prove yourself.
Just like 9.5 weeks, super fucking hot.
Yeah. It's like 9.5 weeks. I'm going to eat all of this food off of you, Marmaduke, and you have to control yourself. You can't have any of it.
Control, yeah. okay, so we then have a local dog show where we're introduced to J.K. Simmons.
A local dog show that is also one of the two levels of dog show. And then the world dog show. Yeah. There's the only two levels.
Which is funny because though the sound of the crowd at this dog show sounds immense, seeing the stands, there's maybe 24 people there.
One of those people though is Michael Winslow, who came to see the Winslow family's dog, and he's doing the sounds of a crowd. Mm-hmm,
so we are introduced to J.K. Simmons, who is in the role of Zeus, who is some kind of like an Afghan or like wolfhound dog.
Yeah.
And he has the shiniest coat. His trainers are these two like vaguely European twins.
They're like was it Nelson? Was that the band?
Yes, similar to Nelson. His coat is so shiny and shimmery. We get multiple shots of people just like obsessively wanting to fuck this dog.
Every single member of the cast gets sparkles in their eyes from this dog's coat and are almost hypnotized, as later they will be hypnotized by the sheer beauty of Zeus on the outside, because inside Zeus is a really ugly character. What is it? I want to ask these two Nelson-esque trainers who are kind of like Euro stylish, what is it about that persona that is that seems to keep popping up in kids' movies, especially. It feels like that was a 90s joke to me. It was the kind of like, oh, what is this? Oh, we're so fancy, like that kind of thing. But it, like, the Ferdinand movie has a characters like that also. And later on, this movie indulges in a series of stereotypes. But what is it about this thing, these things that are kind of like outdated adult comedy things that end up in kids' movies and kids have no frame of reference for them, as far as I know.
I would chalk that up to you. As a comedy writer who is occasionally lazy in this way himself, it is
you?
Lazy comedy writers recycling things that they saw and putting them into their scripts because they don't respect the assignment that they're on. And they're like,
all right, that's fair.
Kids will eat this crap up.
You know, just give them some slop.
It does remind me of something I was told at the Who Was show when I was working there, where the head writer was like, kids don't know it's hacky for us to do a comedy rap sketch. They've never seen him before. Let's do one.
We could trick him.
So because this is a...
So maybe that's it.
New to them.
Because this is a smaller dog show and because Guy has retired and he doesn't want to draw undue attention to Marmaduke, Guy has to go undercover. He dresses up... kind of like an abusive hipster boyfriend type character with like.
Oh, I was gonna say his disguise was like Matthew McConaughey in the beginning of Dallas Buyers Club. Like that's what he reminded me of.
Similar vibes. Zeus sabotages Marmaduke by tempting him with the awards banquet, which Marmaduke devours all of the food that was laid out. Which first off, it's like there's no caterers around. There's so much food.
There's no chafing dishes. Thing, but,
with cartoon catering, they just leave all the food out for hours with no one touching it. And there's also all kinds of foods. There's like a wedding cake. There's a whole turkey, which the uncarved,
there's a bunch of macarons,
which is bonkers.
I don't know if these are dog macarons or just like regular.
Yeah,
it's unclear who this banquet is
so
for.
He eats all this food and he gets like comically fat, but his body, the rest of his body is very skinny and bony. So he kind of looks like the flea women from the castle level in Bloodborne. Which is not cool. Like, this is levels of body horror that, like, David Cronenberg would see and be like,
okay, this
that's real great, Marmaduke.
Right?
No, good job.
I do want to, I want to,
I've been working on that Cronenberg impression.
I agree with Stuart here.
No, that was a great, you really captured the Canadian aspect of Cronenberg and also that he likes to approve of things. That's something that I think.
That sure is disgusting.
I'm sorry if existence was a little too much for you, that kind of thing.
I don't care. I just like orifices. He calls them orifices. I want to assure you guys, I understand Marmaduke is not real. It's a cartoon character.
Okay, good. That's the first step towards accepting the reality around you.
I was
still recognizing what is not part of the reality.
Distressed by this scene because Marmaduke's belly is so distended.
Oh, he's in such pain.
He's like writhing around, and there's one point where like the camera gets really close up, so we like really see like the short hair fur texture, the computer fur texture just takes over, and it looks like, I don't know, like rustling like parts of like a brother's quay. Short or something. It's gross.
There's a brief moment where he lets out an enormous fart and his body gets skinny again, and you're like, oh, maybe the troubles have passed.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
maybe this is a Last King of Scotland moment and he just had a huge fart.
Maybe all the mass inside him has somehow been absorbed.
Well, unfortunately, that is not the case. He blows up again, and he just can't stop farting. And he looks at the camera, and there's a moment where he looks at the camera and says, uh-oh, and then runs toward the doggy bathroom area, only to stop at the first place trophy, and he takes a horribly bad shit that stops time, covers the entire grounds in like a greenish gas, and enough birds are falling out of the sky dead, I can assume, so that they form like a mountain of them.
Yeah, Marmaduke.
Yeah, that was the last flock of passenger pigeons, unfortunately. Yeah,
has murdered several birds, at least, possibly human onlookers. We don't see the aftermath.
We see is because everyone's frozen in time as we pan past them as they experience this gas fog. And I have to admit, this was a moment where I was like, okay, this is a funny. I don't find this funny. I don't find the idea of Marmaduke taking a huge shit funny. Like, but the passing by everybody frozen in time with this very dramatic music. That was a funny idea for it. Uh-huh. And then it ends on a huge pile of dead.
I can only assume that you ran over and you dragged your son into the room to watch this sequence.
Yeah. Like,
no, if only because if my son was watching this, he would have loved it. He would have loved, because kids think nothing is funnier than poop, farts, butts. Again, the height of comedy for my kids is the Minions pants fall off and then a real turd falls out of their butt. So that would be the funniest thing they could imagine.
Like a real, real turd? Like a live
like
action
a photo,
turd?
Yeah, like as if Terry Gilliam snuck in and clipped a poop out of a magazine and then added that to the animation. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, because I thought it would be like, you know, much like dog training, you would be coming in and rubbing Sammy's face in Marmaduke's shit, being like, see, this is what you wanted. This is what you wanted.
Yeah. You got it. Was it worth it?
Yeah.
I feel like in a few years.
I want to make it clear to anyone listening.
I feel like in a few years, Elliot's sons are going to like steal a phone and they're going to start their own like poop and fart based TikTok channel just to drive Elliot crazy.
I mean, drive me crazy until they monetize it. Yeah. Suddenly they're superstars and I can afford to redo my bathroom. Yep. Yeah, that'd be great.
And then Elliot will become their like cool agent guy who'll wear an ascot. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that always works great when a parent becomes the representation for his kids.
There's all of history. There's never been a problem.
As they reach the levels of fame that I always wanted, and now I'm both proud of them and resentful of them for being more successful than me. That's a good emotional stew. Yeah.
The kids are now social pariahs.
Marmaduke shat all over the trophy.
Yeah, he shat all over the trophy. He didn't win. Big surprise. The kids are now social pariahs because their dog is gross, which feels like a stretch.
Yeah.
It does. Well, this is a viral video. Again, this is a viral. This goes viral also. And all the kids are making fun of them. Your dog is gross. But again, if these kids, they're a little older than my kids, but if they're anything like my kids will want nothing more than to be friends with the kid whose dog poops all over everything. Like, they'd have so many questions about the dog's poop. They'd want to see it pooping. Yeah. The other day, Sammy, out of nowhere, he goes, Daddy, didn't you say once that you saw a video of a chimpanzee peeing in its own mouth? And my wife was like, don't talk. We're at the dinner table. She goes, don't talk about that. That's not real. Don't say that. And he was like, but Daddy mentioned it. I was like, well, I did once see a video of a chimpanzee peeing in his own mouth. And he had so many questions about it. It was the thing he wanted to hear about more than anything else. I'll be like, Sammy, let me tell you about this holiday that we celebrate as Jews. It's a part of our heritage. I'm not interested. Tell me about the chimpanzee peeing in his own mouth.
Please. Wait till he finds out about the guy that was in the fucking mosh pit. I think it was at like an origin show, who's like in the middle of the pit and he just whips his dick out and pees in his own face. It's crazy. You got to look at this video.
I don't want to look at it.
It's crazy.
I mean, that sounds like something I should
crazy,
see,
but I don't want to look at it.
I don't want my kids to see that. But for instance, another example, they've never seen it, but they've heard many tales of the videos I've seen of hippopotamuses swinging their tails around like a propeller while they poop. So the poop flings everywhere. I learned recently why they do that. That was not a trick that one hippo did.
Okay,
that's a thing all male
spill,
hippos do.
Baby.
Yeah, yeah. What's the details?
It's just a way of spreading their scent in order to attract mates and
that makes sense.
And kind of mark their territory. Mm-hmm. And honestly, if you had a tail that you could whip around like a helicopter blade, you'd do it, right?
Yeah, of course. This point, Marmaduke's pretty depressed. The family's pretty depressed. There's like a kind of like sad, depressed dinner scene that feels like something out of the middle of Hereditary.
And this is the point in the movie that I referred to before where like, look, I've seen movies before. I know that this is not over. I know that there has to be something, but like it really seems like the way that the movie is done somehow makes it seem like, okay, we've abandoned the idea that Marmaduke is going to be a star. Like, and I'm like, that can't be right. We're 40 minutes in.
Yeah. Guys, I'm looking briefly at the Wikipedia entry for Marmaduke, and I just wanted to give a shout out to whoever wrote the plot summary, because I want to read two sentences for you about the previous scene we were just talking about.
Please.
It says, before one lap around the field, Marmaduke releases voluminous clouds of noxious flatus, which envelopes the entire field. Marmaduke soars through the air and lands backside down in the winner's trophy, releasing his innards to the great dismay of all present. I don't know if H.P. Lovecraft or Harry Stephen Keeler stepped in to write that part of the Wikipedia entry, but excellent work.
Poetic.
Okay, so they also receive a huge bill from Guy the trainer, which Phil, the father, had suggested they were expecting to pay out of Marmaduke's winnings, which is like, oh man, you got scammed, brother.
And also the winnings are $1 million. I don't know if you guys saw the numbers on this bill. It easily adds up to over $20 million. Like, it's crazy. At one point it charges them like $400,000 for one aspect and over $1 million for another aspect. It's like, Guy is really inflating these bills.
Yeah.
You know, it's all those hidden fees. Mm-hmm. I thought Biden was going to take care of that stuff.
That's the real dog shit in this movie. It's not what came out of Marmaduke. It's this guy's bill. So Marmaduke runs away from the family because he feels like he has let everybody down. He's hearing all the naysayers' voices in his head as he runs through the rain, only to be stopped by King Tut, the cat, who convinces him to that
not
no,
the mummy.
Yep, King Tut the mummy. King Tut the cat. That
What a left turn.
He sets
if King Tut the mummy showed up, Marmaduke, I need your help recovering my heart from the British Museum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds like a caper, King Tut.
So Marmaduke decides that he is going to try and convince Guy to come back and train him again. Guy's not having it. He is sick of Marmaduke. Marmaduke has ruined his career. So Marmaduke decides to run around the world like Forrest Gump, kind of. And
he does the only thing he can do to prove that he has what it takes to be a champion dog. And in a very short montage, runs around the entire earth.
Including swimming under the ocean and being chased by a giant shark. This is the point.
Yeah.
Well, all right. There are a couple things in this montage. Okay. Number one, like, he's shown running towards Alaska.
He runs up a pyramid.
You don't think it's realistic. Okay.
He's being shown running to Alaska, and there's a sign that points to Siberia, which is in Russia, and he never goes to Siberia in Russia. At no point during this whole thing
we see him go from Alaska to Russia briefly, you know. We don't see him in Siberia, like a scene of it. We see him on the map. He walks across, I assume the land bridge that was there when the earliest humans came to the North American continent. I assume it's still there in the Marmaduke universe.
I don't think he does. I think he goes over to, like, we see him cross over to, like Korea, and then go down through China because he goes on the Great Wall of China.
We'll put this in the goof section. Anyway, that it's promised that Marmaduke goes to Siberia, but we don't actually see it. It is a montage.
Either way, this is like a nutty montage, like chased by sharks on
it
the Great
Wall.
It comes
out of nowhere.
And this is a part of the movie where I'm like, okay, the movie's been wild up until this point, but surely this is a dream sequence, as we've had Marmaduke dream sequences before.
Yeah.
No, this literally happens in the movie. He wins back the respect of his dog trainer by running solo around the
kind
world.
It's funny because the trainer is still resistant until the family basically humiliates him into taking Marmaduke back.
This was the moment when to be honest, up to this point, I found this movie pretty boring.
Mm.
It seemed like they hadn't, but then suddenly he runs around the world, and I was like, okay, this movie's getting a little strange, like that Marmaduke, one, can accomplish this, two, thinks it's going to solve his problem, and three, that it's tossed off so quickly as almost nothing. Like, yeah, of course Marmaduke runs around the world, the kind of thing that you might find in folklore. Like, if Marmaduke was Paul Bunyan, and they'd be like, well, then he ran around the world and up the pyramids, but that they then just they reject it so quickly, so it can go back to the larger plot about Marmaduke as a dog show contestant, which is not. It's like the movie briefly became a movie and stopped being an episode of the Marmaduke TV show. But then, they go to the trainer is still not convinced until Billy calls him a failure, and he is so overjoyed to finally be called a failure that he has this
weird humiliation fetish.
is that what it is? Because I could not anatomize this. I was like trying to figure out where in his speech that he gives it made any sense what he was talking about, but if he has a humiliation fetish,
clearly
that makes more
like
sense.
He's just not, he's so used to winning that he just needs somebody. Like when you're dealing with somebody who's as powerful and has so much charisma as Guy, the world's greatest dog trainer, like he just wants somebody to knock him down a peg. That's the only way he can get off.
I mean, this made sense logically to me. Like, they're making the point that, like, it's basically a poor workman blames his tools point of, like, you're calling Marmaduke a failure, but if you're really the greatest dog trainer, like, you failed, and like,
well,
you
but
have to show
that makes sense to me. But instead of him vocalizing that, he's kind of like, finally I've been called a failure, thank you, thank you, little boy, for calling me a failure, thank you for being the person who called me a failure, for by calling me a failure you've reminded me failure.
Yeah.
That's the failure. And it was like, it felt like the Vatican scene in Aline, where it was like, how many times is he going to say the word failure?
Yeah.
Like, but it just, it just feels like it's especially the 1-2 punch of this scene after the Marmaduke running around the world scene. I was I was so mind boggled by the fact that the movie was like, well, there's only one solution. Marmaduke's got to run around the whole world. And you know what? We're not going to spend that much time on it.
Yeah.
So Guy pulls some strings and gets them entered into the World Dog Championships. We now flash forward to the big city.
Pulls some strings by... Wait, this is something I want to... Hold on just for a second. He calls, I guess, the head of the World Dog Championship, who's this woman who seems to have a crush on him. And he's like... Well, she's like, anything for you, Guy. And he's like, and keep your schedule open. Remember that dinner place I took you to? Oh, yes. Well, I'd love to. But then a couple scenes later, Guy sees her and is very nervous about talking to her and is like, it seems like their dynamic has suddenly shifted entirely.
Yeah.
Well,
he's just good over, he's way nervous. Better over the phone, you know?
Well, no, I mean, but at first, I do think it's set up as if, like, this is a manipulation he's going to do on this totally lovelorn person. But instead, they're both, like, bashful in love with each other, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Guy really, he has kind of an almost heel turn very early in the movie, but then I guess he's a pretty boy when it comes down to it.
Yeah, becomes a baby face. Okay, so.
Baby face, that's what I meant when I said pretty boy. I meant baby face.
So then we get, I mean, he's also a pretty boy.
I was thinking of Pretty Boy Nelson, the gangster.
We get the arrival of all the other dogs that are competing. These are dogs from other countries. These are dogs that, in many cases, are racist stereotypes.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, hey, there's a chihuahua from Mexico. Guess what his favorite food is? Hey, guys.
Oh, no.
It's a taco. Hey, guess what the talent of the Chinese dog is? Kung fu and mysticism. Yeah. And apparently rapping, although that doesn't get mentioned as part of the description.
The rapping part was the best part. Yeah.
The French dog, I looked up.
Chantrell?
Yeah, I looked up who did it, and it's a professional voice actor, and I don't know. I looked it up because I'm like, this French accent is so bad. I'm sorry to the voice actor who did it. I think it's probably less an indication on her talent because she appears to be highly in demand and more an indication of she correctly clocked the amount of effort she needed to put into this Marmaduke movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, these are all pretty bad, like, ethnic stereotypes.
We get some scenes of like Zeus talking shit to all the other dogs. We're also introduced to a really cool muscle dog from England, Vinny. I'm a big fan. So we actually get to the competition itself. And I think the first category is the dogs have to show their self-control. So they are presented with their favorite food that has bacon added to it. So Juan Pedro, the dog from Mexico.
This is another case. They say the word bacon so many times throughout this sequence. And this is another case where it feels like kids are getting kind of leftover jokes. We all remember the period about, 10 years ago where bacon was suddenly the funniest food. And it was around I feel like there was a hipster joke catalog that was like, unicorns, bacon, handlebar mustaches, and pirates. And
Chuck Norris. And
now kids get that stuff. Yeah. And what?
Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris. Yeah, all that stuff. Yeah, sure.
Also, I realize it's a cartoon, but I'm like, this is not something that happens in a dog show where we see other dogs can resist food.
They don't present each dog with their favorite food that has additional bacon added to it. So Juan Pedro is presented with a bacon taco, which he is, of course, unable to resist. He bites it and is, I guess, cast into limbo. He is disqualified for the competition.
Yeah, he's sent to the Phantom Zone. I will give the movie credit for not having him say Quiero Taco as a nod to the old Taco Bell commercials. Yeah. That's kind of reference to an old thing kids won't know about that you might see in a kind of second or third string. Yeah,
except for otherwise he is that character,
is that character otherwise entirely. Yeah.
After getting some inspirational words from Xi, the magical dog, Marmaduke is able to resist the slice of bacon pizza he is presented with.
Tell us what the magical advice is.
That he has to become the bacon or be the bacon, I believe. Yeah. So
to defeat the bacon, he has to become the bacon.
Yeah, he imagines that his own face is coming out of a portal, a magical portal that is in the middle of the slice of pizza that's presented to him. And weirdly enough, the portal extends to the rear side of the pizza slice where Marmaduke's tail is sticking out.
You might be wondering, is Stuart making this up? He is not. This is what happens in the film.
No. And this is not a whimsical flight of fancy. This hallucinatory simulacrum of Marmaduke. He tells Marmaduke, I'm the bacon. I'm you. I wouldn't eat me. Would you eat me? Would you eat yourself?
Yeah.
And it's like,
I'd eat me. Would you eat me?
Yeah, then Ray Liotta comes out noshing on his own brain from Hannibal.
Wow. Yeah.
Don't knock layers it till you layers, try it. Yeah. Yeah. But it's one of those things where what we're seeing doesn't make sense, but in this case, they go so far to explain the reasoning to Marmaduke so that he won't eat this piece of pizza. But I guess it works. You can't knock success because, Stuart, what happens?
He doesn't eat the pizza, and hooray, he, I guess, survives to the next round.
Who does eat the pizza?
Oh, yeah, his trainer eats the pizza, right?
There's this weird running gag of Guy eating all the food that Marmaduke wants to eat and eating it the way that a snake would eat it, where he just drops the whole thing into his mouth and his throat just pulls it down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's showing off his throat game for this woman that he's interested in.
Oh, God.
So, during the agility competition, Zeus...
Stuart, how would Game of Thrones be different if it was called Game of Throats?
Oh, that already exists. It's on the Brazzers Network, Elliot.
Okay, forget I asked. Never mind.
So during the agility competition, Zeus, who performs quite well, attempts to sabotage Marmaduke by using some of the Zeus's brand of shampoo.
At both of these dog shows, Zeus has had a setup of shampoo to sell, uh-huh, his own brand of shampoo.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems like a conflict of interest that he's both a contestant and also has a merchandising table right in the competition area.
Well,
right?
That sounds like there's something wrong with that. Perhaps that there's some corruption at the higher levels, which maybe this is just a clue. He squirts some of his shampoo and Marmaduke gets it all over his feet. But somehow his natural clumsiness works out perfectly and Marmaduke is able to complete the agility competition perfectly, except at the end, he accidentally injures his trainer, Guy, and Guy has to go to the hospital, and Marmaduke won't be able to compete anymore.
Now, I want to say, when he slips and slides his way at great speed through this obstacle course because he has stepped in shampoo, like, this shampoo seems to be, like, self-generating. Like, he keeps having more shampoo come out of his paws as if, like, you know, he's on, like, a sketch comedy show where he has to, like, throw up and they have, like, a tube through the sleeves. Like, there's a lot. This is amazing shampoo. It lasts.
I mean, it's $99.99. Yeah, and it's a dress.
It's expensive dog shampoo. And also, I think there was a missing scene where in order to defeat Thor, Loki gifted Marmaduke with the ability to absorb elements make them part of his body. And so he's using that tool here to absorb the shampoo and thus generate more shampoo. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, but
I think there was... Because Thor was going to be part of this movie, and then Marvel pulled out at the last minute of making the Marmaduke Cinematic Universe part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yep.
And so they had to replace Thor with the mom with the huge butt.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But with a trainer in the hospital, they can't compete, which I was like, really? They can't? And as we see through the movie, like, that is dispensed with pretty quickly.
Very quickly. The family's like, oh, we'll just do it. And they're like, okay, that's fine.
Emotionally, the dad has had a real turnabout. The dad was always the one who was like, Marmaduke needs training. Marmaduke's a big problem.
Uh-huh.
Now he recognizes, you know what? Marmaduke's great. And he does have a trainer now. Team Winslow, which I don't know if you can have a family as your trainer.
Yeah, Dan, you're the expert on dog shows. Can you have a family as trainers?
I think my expertise ends at knowing that you don't just put food in front of them and say, can you resist it? But
yeah, I can't.
Let's talk about the talent.
Oh, yeah, the talent show. Okay, talent competition. This is where things get good, guys. My favorite dog, the muscle dog, manages to deadlift the entire building. And one bitch gives him a fucking 8 out of 10. It's crazy.
Yeah.
These judges are bonkers. That's so much weight.
It's that dog is not just the strongest dog. That dog is the strongest organism that has ever existed on Earth.
Yeah.
And yet, 8 out of 10, that's all he gets.
It's wild. Especially,
he's lifting the building that he's in.
Yeah.
Which, talk about
especially
cartoon
because
physics. That should be impossible.
The next talent is Chantrell, the French dog, doing, as they describe, a seductive dance.
Mm. They do say seductive,
and people lose their
weird
fucking minds, and she gets a 9 out of 10.
Well, they're so horny for this dog, Stuart. You don't understand. Yeah. You were there.
Oh, man, I guess. And then Xi, the Chinese dog, does this, like, dance battle that also kind of turns into a rap, but not really. And there's magic, and there's spears flying around.
I had to rewind this part because there's rap on the soundtrack, and Xi's mouth is kind of moving, but it's not exactly timed, and it's not super clear. So I was like, is Xi supposed to be rapping?
Uh-huh.
Or is and I guess he is.
Yeah.
It's just like...
And the whole thing ends in a yin-yang symbol. It's pretty cool.
And he's performing with his surprisingly scantily clad trainer. Everyone else is wearing just regular clothes, regular everyday clothes. But this trainer is always in kind of like...
Looks like a Soul Calibur character.
Yes, yeah, exactly. We're in like a martial arts bathing suit or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird choice. This whole moment is a strange talent. Yeah. But I'd be like, Xi, pick one lane and stick with it because you're trying to combine too many things.
Yeah, I don't know. I still think it was pretty cool. Okay.
Before you deliver this meal to the judges, take one element off the plate. You got too much going on the plate.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But it's at least it's well seasoned. That's the thing. The worst is when they bring the food out and it isn't fucking seasoned. Like, come on.
No,
respect
your protein. It's cooked.
Yeah.
It's cooked perfectly. The seasoning is spot on. I'm just not sure. What is this dish telling me?
And
what's
the other
philosophy
thing is,
behind
like,
this dish?
If the main element of the dish is the wrap, you got to respect the wrap. You got to put more.
Exactly.
That has to be the star of the dish.
This was a wrap challenge, and yet you're giving me a martial arts dish with a little bit of wrap in it. And I've got to dock you points no matter how delicious the dish is. It's not meeting the challenge. I'm sorry, Xi. Pack your knives and go to the next round.
Well, yeah. Xi, I didn't like your performance. I loved it. Okay, so Zeus then performs, and his talent is basically hypnotizing everybody in the audience using the luster of his hair.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he kind of hypnotizes
everybody.
And making
them slap themselves and making them act like dogs. It's very sadistic. And here's an issue that I have with Zeus. Zeus is convinced where's Roxanne? And two, Zeus, that was not okay for you to appear before all those women as different animals and weather and things like that and make them have your babies. That's not okay. Zeus,
you're
canceled.
Why in modern pop culture, like in this movie and No Holds Barred, is Zeus portrayed as a bad guy when in Greek mythology, he's only a good dude, right?
No, that's not. Even in Greek mythology, he's often a bad guy. I think that's something I admire about the Greeks.
He doesn't cause problems.
I don't admire. The ancient Greeks, they were like, gods? Yeah, they're just like us, but they're worse. Like, gods are just bigger jerks because they're bigger people. Whereas they didn't have truck with our modern notions of morality. Their gods, look, you'd see a picture of Zeus carrying a big thing of kitty litter in the parking lot, and it would say, Zeus, he's just like us. The gods, they're no different than we are. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Zeus is convinced that he's going to win. He knows he's the best dog. So why does he have to bother sabotaging Marmaduke, hypnotizing the audience? Because his last command to the audience from his trainer is, you're going to give Zeus a perfect score. And also, as we're about to see, that they've gotten in with the judges. Like, there's one judge who's giving every dog zeros except for Zeus, who she gives a 100 and then sheepishly takes the extra zero away. That it's just a 10.
You gotta have redundancies, Elliot.
That's so many redundancies. Yeah. It shows a lack of confidence to me. So many redundancies.
Yeah, that's true.
But you're right. I guess in case the hypnotism plan fails, you've got your person on the inside. And in case that fails, you can sabotage Marmaduke, who is already the clumsiest, dumbest of the dogs.
In case that fails, you can just be the prettiest dog already.
it's almost like Zeus, the only reason to sabotage Marmaduke is if you know Marmaduke is the name of the movie that you're in. Otherwise, sabotage Xi, this amazing dog that can rap and also do martial arts. Sabotage the seductive Chanterelle.
You would think, yeah. So speaking of Marmaduke, he is able to re-enter the competition because his family are his trainers. And he does this like Wild West themed stunt show where King Tut the Cat, who says, where they're like shooting bullets at him as he is playing the outlaw Blackbird.
Every time he dodges
a bullet, he says meow, which I thought was very cool.
So this is playing off. Earlier we saw there's a game that Billy likes to play with Marmaduke, where he rides Marmaduke and pretends he's a cowboy and King Tut is an outlaw they're chasing. So they do this stunt show where he's riding around a Marmaduke, and there's a full section of the stunt show that is just Billy shooting real bullets at King Tut as King Tut dodges them.
And says meow.
And Marmaduke is just standing there. And if I was the judges, I would say disqualified. The cat is doing all the work.
Yeah.
Marmaduke is not doing any work. But Marmaduke realizes that, I guess, because that's when it turns into an epic dance party.
It does turn into an epic dance party, which obviously is great. Everybody's into it. Even Zeus can't help himself. He has to dance along despite himself. And we've all been there. You know, you hear a song where you're like, I hate this song. And by the end of the thing, you're like, since you've been gone, you know.
Or that Saturday Night's Gonna Get It. What's that that song
from Fighting?
No, the one Uptown Funk. That's the
Uptown
one I'm thinking
Funk.
About. Uptown Funk,
sure.
Which is an objectively bad song. It's an objectively bad song, but you can't help but dance to it because it taps into the amygdala, I guess. But
I mean,
otherwise,
I like it less than Since You've Been Gone. I know that Stuart probably just pulled the first thing out of his mind. He doesn't
actually
want to
insult Since You've Been Gone. I kind of pulled the first thing out of my mind.
I mean, Since You've Been Gone is not really like a dance song. It's not really a dance song.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
But a song like YMCA.
Thanks for covering my bases, Dan.
Yeah, well, I cannot truck with any insult to that great ditty.
And the dance,
grandma and grandpa used to Charleston too. Since you've been gone.
You're like, what's the word that could possibly do justice to this magnificent opus?
I wish
opus?
The Kaiser
Diddy.
Would go.
So Marmaduke's performance.
It ends with indoor fireworks in a very small arena. The fireworks are literally going off in people's faces.
Which animals are known for being very cool with.
Yeah, animals love fireworks.
So, and we rewound this multiple times to make sure. At no point do they show Marmaduke's score.
Mm-hmm. No, not
they're all there's a standing ovation, but we don't actually know what his score is. So
because to give it a number value would be to insult the integrity and the beauty of it. Yeah, exactly.
It's why like I prefer review sites that like stop giving records or movies like a star rating and instead are just like, here's what it's all about. Like you make up your own mind. So we do the final judging. Zeus wins, of course. Uh-oh. But Marmaduke realizes that one of the judges is just one of Zeus's trainers in disguise, reveals that. And Zeus is disqualified. Uh-oh. So G wins. That's crazy. Okay, he's not even the main character, but he is magic. And then Zeus tries to steal the trophy.
And they want this movie to be shown in Chinese theaters, I assume. Yeah, so you got to have the Chinese dog win. Yeah.
So Zeus tries to steal the trophy, only for Marmaduke to use the magical kick technique that he had wanted to learn and he was obsessed with.
Did we ever mention that G has telekinesis also?
I said magic a couple times. I guess telekinesis is a little different.
Yeah, it's like he is the Force.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's never really explained other than the fact that he is generally Chinese mystic type. So it's like that it's just assumed that he has magic and can control objects from afar. And instead of removing the judge's fake wig, he instead uses his telekinesis to make a shampoo bottle go over to Marmaduke. So Marmaduke can throw it?
Yeah,
so he
throw
can
it so
trip
the wig
on it.
Comes off.
Mm-hmm. It's like a butterfly
effect
thing.
Yeah.
So Marmaduke stops. Marmaduke manages to stop Zeus, but in the ensuing chaos, a cameraman on a platform is about to come crashing down, and Marmaduke pushes Billy out of the way, only to be crushed by the falling cameraman. What? Marmaduke is dead? Everyone surrounds him? Phil does a eulogy over Marmaduke's dead body, and everyone starts to fucking
Stuart
cry.
Stuart is saying this as if he's making it up as he goes along, but this is exactly what's happening in the movie.
Even Guy is watching this on TV, and despite being covered in bandages like an invisible man, he is crying his little eyes out. But it turns out Marmaduke...
I like the implication that the invisible man can't cry.
If he can't see his tears, is he really crying?
Oh, that's a good point. Not to talk about my kids too much. They've been really into the Invisible Man lately. We watched the original Claude Rains movie. They loved it, and they find it hilarious that the Invisible Man is naked all the time. And I think now they have something to aspire to.
You said
is to be
said
invisible,
watched,
so they can not.
You watch Hollow Man, is what you said. You watch with your kids.
I showed them Hollow Man. I said you got to see the original.
Mm-hmm.
And my kids were like, we thought we were watching the Elizabeth Moss Invisible Man. And I was like, no. You got to watch them in order.
Elliot's like, too woke for you guys. Phil does his eulogy over Marmaduke. Marmaduke
and
actually
then
is not
I'm watching Hollow
dead.
Man, and I'm going, this isn't based on the T.S. Eliot poem. Hold on a second.
Yeah. So Marmaduke wakes up. Everyone is happy, except for Zeus, of course. And then, so Marmaduke wins the day. Everybody loves him. Okay, now we get end credits, guys.
Although, speaking of plot threads that aren't resolved, I guess we are to believe that the trainer just forgives the debt because now he loves Marmaduke. Because, as we said, Marmaduke didn't win the big prize. So that is just left hanging.
I mean, we could only assume he's going to get some kind of sponsorships and they can pay that bill.
I guess.
I mean, Marmaduke
but, you know,
goes
put
on
like
to
a
Marmaduke
line
goes,
in the movie.
I mean, Marmaduke goes on to become a huge movie star. So
yeah.
I feel like
so
it's, yeah.
speak as we mentioned, there was like a funky Marmaduke song, which is how these end credits began until the song changes to a Marmaduke rap by Pete Davidson. And it is one of the worst things I've ever heard. And I can only assume it's some kind of like elaborate fucking troll of Kanye West or something that he's like, I'm going to do the shittiest rap possible. And he is going to have to listen to it because he hates me so bad. and he's going to have to listen to this whole fucking thing, and it is the worst. Guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good theory, I think. It is.
He approaches this rap with the level of energy that, like, I don't know, that I make, like, ordering something at a fucking Shake Shack or something. I don't know.
Oh, look, online.
I mean, in Pete Davidson's defense, how much energy should he bring to the Marmaduke rap in the end credits of the Marmaduke movie?
I was trying to find the lyrics to the Marmaduke rap, which I couldn't find, but I did find I can get the chords to the Marmaduke rap if you want me.
Oh, yeah, the fucking guitar tablature.
Guitar and play.
Okay, so that was Marmaduke, everybody. Hooray, we did it.
Yeah.
Well, and wait, and during the credits, there is there's a series of fake movie posters for Marmaduke movies. Mm-hmm. Now he's a big movie star. And there's not exactly an end credit scene. There's just a little bit of footage of him eating, I think. But watching this on Netflix, anytime the credits start, it's like, you want to watch a trailer for another movie, right? Yeah. Let me skip right to it. So I had to keep rewinding in order to finally catch the most almost non-existent end credits scene ever. Thanks, Netflix, for doing that. I appreciate it.
And it's also brought up, I want to point out that all of, like, the movies in, like, for the movie posters are all movies that are at least 20 years old. Like, there's no new movie that Marmaduke has been.
So they're like parodies of existing movies.
Yeah, it's like Jaws is Paws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a Spider Marmaduke. You know.
I think there's Fast and Furious, which is a joke that predates the Fast and Furious movies, because that was the name of a Wile E. Coyote Roadrunner cartoon, you know, in the 1950s.
So,
arguably inspired the Fast and Furious franchise.
Yeah.
I will say, though, there was part of me that as the rap was going on was like, well, you know what? Pete Davidson, I guess, is earning his money here, because there's no way that anyone is enjoying doing this. And it's a long rap. It goes on for a while.
Yes.
No, I did.
I feel like it's a bit.
I did have that thought that, like, wow, they actually convinced him to do this. Because I bet Pete Davidson could have put his foot down saying, no, I'm not going to do a rap about Marmaduke.
They already have a funky Marmaduke song.
Yeah.
I mean, but also I have to assume that once you've got Pete Davidson signed to do your Marmaduke movie, he's a broken shell of a man. He's going to do whatever you tell him to do, you know.
I don't know. He seems like he's doing like okay.
His mistake was saying, hey, yeah, I'll do the voice for that Marmaduke movie.
Yeah. Okay, well, final judgments. Is this a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, a movie kind of like, you know what?
Wait a second. Do you think this is why... Do you think this is why Kate Beckinsale was dating him to get him to do the Marmaduke movie?
Marmaduke.
Or maybe that was it. To get close to Marmaduke.
Must love dog, she says. Mm-hmm. Was she in that? Mm-hmm. I can't even remember.
I'm going to say probably not.
Anyway. Probably not?
Like,
let's look it up.
If you no-scope that shit and you just like...
That was Diane Lane was the male lead.
Cusack. I see.
Oh, remember when she and Pete Davidson dated?
John Cusack. I think because Serendipity was John Cusack and Kate Beckinsale. That was my 6 degrees of Marmaduke that I was doing.
Yeah. Okay.
But, okay. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I'm an idiot.
Sure. I get it now.
Anyway.
I don't know how anyone. Now I don't understand how anyone doesn't make that mistake.
Final judgments. I'm going to say, look, if this occurred way earlier in our Flophouse career when I was less beaten down, I might say this is a good, bad movie because it is legitimately very strange. And like for Netflix to put this out with some name actors, like it is wild that it is as bad as it is, but even at 88 minutes, it's just too much. I would say if you're curious, maybe watch some highlights. You have Netflix already, I'm pretty sure. Just fast forward through, watch a little bit, maybe the tsunami, maybe the farting, I don't know. And then go about your day. But what do you guys have to say?
Go about your day.
Yeah.
After living your life is what you're doing
first thing. First thing in the morning, this is what you're doing.
Start the day off right with a little Marmaduke.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bad, bad movie. I mean, this is obviously, I'm not the target demographic. I'm not, I don't know, a child?
Some sort of sick child?
Some monstrous freak? But yeah, so no, this is a bad, bad movie. What, no thanks.
Am I some sort of hideous thing aborning?
Yeah.
Slouching towards Bethlehem?
Elliot, what do you think?
I'm going to say... I'm going to say bad, bad movie. This is, I didn't find it as goofy as Dan did. And this is one of those movies where there were many times during it where I was like, I cannot believe that I'm spending my time watching this. But you know what?
On a holiday weekend.
On a holiday weekend, yeah, for the Flophouse listeners. This is how I'm spending my post-Thanksgiving is watching this movie. But there are times, I go back and forth with these movies all the time because I'm like, I don't like that they exist, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it's work for people. Like, they're making money off of it. Like, there's somebody needed the work that this created. But on the mm-hmm. other hand, like many animated movies, I'm sure that they push the animators to deliver things at an unrealistic deadline.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the reason why it looks so crappy. And for too low a budget. So I don't know. I'm a real mixed bag on this movie, except that I agree that it's terrible.
Yeah,
and
it's
I think that the 0.9 rating on Letterboxd was
charitable.
A bit high. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah,
it was a bit
degenerous. Like I was at my bar and I was leaving and I bumped into a podcast listener, Will. Sorry I couldn't stay and talk. But I had to leave because I had to run home to watch this thing. So I missed an opportunity for actual human connection with another person. And instead, I got Marmaduke.
Well, I mean, you got
yeah. I think
you got all this
I
human
only,
connection with us as a result.
Oh, that's true. This is the real.
Yeah, but there are no Will. I can only congratulate myself. I'm earning that world's greatest dad mug by not letting my son watch this movie with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Much as I also didn't let him watch The Munsters with me, although he was less interested in that one.
Hi, I'm looking for a movie.
Oh, I gotcha.
There's that new foreign film with the time travel.
There's an amazing documentary about queer history on streaming.
Have I told you about this classic where giant robots fight?
Or there's that one that most critics hated, but I thought was actually pretty good.
Ooh, I know. The one with the huge car chase, and then there's that scene where
the car jumps over the submarine.
Wow, who are you eclectic movie experts?
Well, I'm Ivy Wadiway.
I'm Drea Clark.
And I'm Alonso Duraldi. And together, we host the movie podcast, Maximum Film.
New episodes every week on MaximumFun.org.
And you actually just walked into our recording booth.
Oh, weird. Sorry. I thought this was a video store.
You seem like a lady with a lot of problems.
Hey, it's John Moe, inviting you to listen to Depresh Mode with John Moe, where I talk about mental health and the lives we live with all kinds of people. Famous writers.
David Sedaris, welcome to Depresh Mode.
Thanks so much for having me.
Movie stars.
Jamie Lee Curtis, welcome to Depresh Mode.
I am happy to be here.
Musicians.
I am in St. Paul, Minnesota. I'm talking to Amy Mann.
Great to talk to you.
And song exploders.
Hrishikesh Hirway, welcome to Depresh Mode.
Thanks so much for having me.
Everyone's opening up on Depresh Mode on Maximum Fun.
Hey, the podcast, the Flophouse, the one you're listening to, that's the podcast I'm referring to, is sponsored, is made possible in large part by listeners like you who have joined the Maximum Fun Network. Well, but we also get a little bit from sponsors, which
oh yeah, you're right, sponsors.
Which is the other thing that I'm trying to introduce. And our sponsor this week is Microdose Gummies. You've probably heard about microdosing. If not, know that all sorts of people are microdosing daily to feel healthier and perform better. Our show is sponsored by Microdose Gummies, which deliver perfect entry-level doses of THC that help you feel just the right amount of good. If you want sort of the mood-elevating effect, the boost your creativity, the sleep help that THC gummy can give you, but you don't want to be, let's say, a little too addled, maybe a microdose gummy is good for you. I like them. They're available nationwide. Microdose is available nationwide. To learn more about microdosing THC, go to microdose.com and use code FLOP, FLOP, that spells FLOP, to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, that's microdose.com, code FLOP. I think that there are a few plugs, including Stuart. Let's start off with this one.
Yay! So it's that time of year. That's right. The holiday season, baby. Woo! And to celebrate, we're going to be doing, mainly me and Dan are going to be doing a little party over on my Twitch channel on Wednesday night, December 14th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we are going to be hanging out in Dan's kitchen, Dan is going to be cooking up a feast while I fuck with him. We're going to be making cocktails. We're going to be goofing around. And we invite you to join us. My Twitch channel is Stuart Wellington over at Twitch. And you can also, I'm sure we'll put a link to it in the show notes for this episode. And it's just going to be, you know, like an hour or so of us hanging out and answering questions and goofing off.
Yeah. If you like the Flophouse, but you're like, I want it to be a cooking show. Now's your chance.
Exactly. The thing is, I've been pushing Dan to do more cooking based content on various platforms and he fights me. Mm-hmm. So this is my chance. This is me tricking him into doing it.
Bite his hand.
And maybe a special guest might show up. Special guest might be Elliot.
Possibly, if we can get the technology to work. That'll be an exciting cooking show for our spinoff, The Cookhouse.
And it's, you know, it's just a free little extra show as a holiday thank you to listeners. Anything else to plug, guys?
I have a temporary de-plug, unfortunately. I've been mentioning on the last few episodes that my new comic book, Maniac of New York, Don't Call It a Comeback, #1, comes out December 7th. I've received the unfortunate news that the publication is being pushed slightly to a later date.
Oh, no.
I don't know when yet. So if you go on December 7th and to your local comic book store and they don't have this book, do not get mad. Do not get sad. Just stay glad, because it will be coming at some point.
It'll still be rad.
You know. It'll still be rad. I'll let you know at some point when it's coming out, but that publication date is TBD, which means to be Dan. So, mm-hmm. Dan, I guess you're the publication date. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks.
Which means you're my date to the publication party. That's when we have a party next to the printing press where it's being printed. It's very loud. It hurts your ears. But you're my date. You got to come with me.
Okay.
Uh-huh, sure. So,
why don't you wear that slinky backless number, you know, I like so much?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Not going to fight it.
I mean, the printing press is hot. You're going to want no back on your dress.
Yeah, just don't back up onto the press.
Yeah, of course not. You don't want to get burns.
I mean, it's a general just good idea just not to touch a printing press when it's working.
Mm-hmm. Is that it? Or should we move?
Can
we move
on? I think we can move on.
Okay. This next part of the show is letters from listeners like you.
Like us?
Well, I mean, you're not, I guess, do you listen to the show?
Sometimes.
Okay. Well, I guess if you wrote a letter in, maybe I would read it. But mostly non-host.
What if I write one right
listeners.
Now? Dear Dan, this is Elliot, your co-host on the show. No. I have a question for you and the other floppers, because I'm such a big fan.
Yep.
so you won't take it now? All right.
Yeah.
I'll send you my letter off the air then, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this first one is
going to be a really good question.
Matthew, last name withheld. By the way, I want to say, I'm not very good at it a lot of the time. I try and get the letters out to...
And by it, you mean everything?
Yeah. I try and
just
get the
kidding.
Letters
Dan's
out
good a lot of things.
To Stuart and Elliot a little bit before we actually tape, so they can think about any questions that may be in it. Mm-hmm. I forgot this time because I was on break and too busy not doing anything.
Dan was so not busy that he forgot to do it.
I think that people understand. I mean, like, if you have like a schedule,
he's in vacation brain, dude.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's something that I was once told by a famous person: you get better service in a busy restaurant.
Yeah.
So like, when there's a lot going on, it's easier to stay on task. Yeah.
Yeah. I apologize that, you know, maybe these won't be as, I haven't given enough time to reflect, but we'll see.
You're like, the first question is, Stuart and Elliot, can you write me a 5-paragraph essay explaining this thing?
Yeah.
Oh, right now, off the top of my head? Oh, okay. Wow.
This is from Matthew, last name withheld, who writes, Ahoy, Peaches.
I have to assume Matthew Lesko, famous for sending out books about free money you can get from the government.
Does he have a suit that looks like money?
He has a suit with question marks.
Yeah.
Oh. Like a Riddler.
Oh, no, maybe it's money on the... you know, it's question marks. It's question marks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe to him, questions are money.
Yeah.
you know the old saying, it takes questions to make money.
Yeah. This is from...
Because the question is usually, how do I make money?
Yet again, Matthew says, Ahoy, Peaches. I had a great time listening to your recent
he's the ship's captain.
Episode about the Munsters. Because I'm slightly younger than you guys, I watched my old Munsters returns on TV Land rather than Nick at Night. In those days, the channel ran promos for the Munsters that poked fun at the show's premise by way of explanatory lyrics set to the tune of the show's theme song. On reflection, I realize that my memories of these promos are much more vivid than my memories of the show itself. Which brings me to my question. What are some examples of movie advertising that struck you as particularly clever or memorable? This could include trailers, posters, or anything else. Bonus points if it was much better than the movie deserved. Floppily yours, Matthew, last name withheld. I want to...
Mordecai, right? Mordecai, where all the cast have little mustaches. People love that
mustaches.
Shit.
Mustaches, yeah. People went crazy for that little mustache. Just mustache fever swept the nation, yeah.
This actually, you know, this was not
mustache
a movie.
Mustache fever. Bow now, now. That was the hit song from Mordecai.
Yeah. Uh-huh. This is a movie that was made before I was around. I'm going to look it up. The actual date, 1978. Okay, the year of my birth. Magic. I did not see it at the time.
Yeah.
But this is famously a television ad that is scarier than the movie, I would argue. Magic's a fun movie. Good.
It's
Anthony,
fine. It's an okay movie.
Anthony Hopkins performance. William Goldman wrote it. But look up the Magic TV ad and see why it traumatized a generation. That's the one I thought of.
That's a good one. It promises a much scarier movie than what actually results.
Yeah.
Similarly, this won't come as a surprise since I've now written three volumes of a comic book roughly based on the promise of this ad. Third volume, of course, coming out TBD. The Jason Takes Manhattan advertisements, they just promised Jason taking Manhattan in a way that he didn't in the movie Jason Takes Manhattan. And so,
yeah, I mean, spoiler alert, but that's okay.
Spoiler alert, the movie's not very good. But those ads really, like, when I was younger, yeah, they really burrowed into my head. I'll think of some other ones. Stuart, what else have you got?
Oh, man, I got to do something other than Mordecai? I mean, that's such a fucking banger.
If you want to go with the joke answer, sure, that's fine.
Fine. I wasn't going to remember this, Stuart, that I wasn't the one who gave you a hard time for once.
Yeah.
This one's from Duncan, last name withheld.
Okay, Duncan, Idaho.
Duncan Hines. Yep.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Duncan, Idaho, Duncan Hines. You put Hines on Idaho potatoes. Oh, my Lord.
Whoa. We're through the looking glass, everybody.
What?
This is wheels within wheels.
I thought you were going to construct a name called Hines, Idaho. And I was like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that's Duncan Idaho's German cousin, Heinz Idaho. Yeah.
Yep.
Against my better judgment.
Why do I not also become a giant kind of clone worm?
Mm-hmm.
Against my better judgment, mm-hmm. I've continued to watch the Marvel movies and as a result been steadily driven insane with the confusion that's now arisen with the whole multiverse concept. I can no longer tell which, quote, version of a character it is I'm seeing, and I frankly can't see how any action that takes place in this movie has any consequence, since it can be easily retconned by bringing back dead characters or objects or worlds. I know the point is probably just to stop thinking and watch the glowy things go boom, but I thought since you guys seem to have a very special set of comic-related skills, I'd put the question to you, how do I make sense of this nonsense in my mind? And if you were in charge of the MCU, what would you signpost to viewers to help them with what they're seeing, i.e. would one parallel universe have a prefix to their titles like Dark World or something? Well, not that. They already used it. Much love. Wasting brain space in Australia, Duncan. I mean, my response is what Elliot has already hinted at. Like, this is just what comics are. They've been retconned so many times. You just can't get, like, the longer something goes on, the bigger the world gets, the more unwieldy. So you can't, like, that stuff's all just fun stuff to have in the back of your head if you want it, but you should live in the moment, dude.
I think that's a big part of it. Live in the moment, dude. I think part of the problem is, I think there is a real issue, I think, with people who are not used to those concepts now being confronted with them. And the movie is, I agree, not doing enough of a job of differentiating those multiverses. In the comics, there's always the evil universe. There's the version where somebody else has the costume, a different member of the supporting cast has become the hero. They've hinted at that a little bit. But I think part of the problem is that, especially in like Multiverse of Madness, a bunch of those multiverse characters that we're seeing rely on knowledge from previous iterations of these characters. Like if you're watching Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, you only know things from Marvel movies. It's not going to be fun to you that Patrick Stewart comes out to the X-Men theme song from the 1990s in the yellow floaty wheelchair. It's not going to be fun to you that Reed Richards, a character you have never encountered before, shows up.
The smartest man in the world being played by John Krasinski.
I mean, it's fine. But I think that there's a level of this concept that I think they are not doing a great job of like making the most of it in a simple way that doesn't require a lot of extra knowledge. But you're right. This is what being a comics fan is all about. And what's amazing to me is that, so the Marvel Universe has existed for 14 years in the movie world with the first Iron Man. And in 14 years, they've managed to get to the point that the Marvel Comics universe took 30 years to get to. The 1990s, when there were too many books, too many different versions of characters, the continuity was too thick, and people started losing interest because the overall quality was going down, and there was just too much to keep track of. And it's like, oh man, movies are so much more efficient than comic books. It took them half as long to get to a point of incomprehensibility to the casual viewer. But I think that if I was in charge of the Marvel movies, what I would do is like simplify it quite a bit. I think they're forgetting that the one of the things that made them so successful was getting us invested in the characters before the characters started interacting and getting all put together. And that what's the first kind of nod to an Easter egg nod to someone? Is that when like Captain America's shield shows up for like a second was it Iron Man 2 or something? That like those things were handled as like, wink, you don't need to know about this, but wink. Whereas now when Star Fox and Pip the Troll show up at the end of Eternals, it's incomprehensible. Or like Patrick Stewart shows up not even as the Professor X from the X-Men movies, but as the Professor X from the cartoon show from the 90s. It's just so you're in the thicket when you could just be not putting as much plot weight on that and not treating it like each movie is the important thing in each movie is not the plot or what happens with the characters, but instead what new character from the Marvel Universe is going to be introduced. I feel like once I found out that Namor was in Wakanda Forever, part of the interest in seeing it went down for me because I was like, okay, well, I know the next building block that's being introduced. That's, you know what? I don't trust that those movies are going to give me like a full character story anymore. Maybe that's a bad example. I haven't seen it and I heard it's good.
Yeah, I liked Wakanda Forever quite a bit, but I wouldn't. Namor, like, I don't care so much because he's like given full villain weight. You know, like, sure, introduce him in this as the new villain and then he can be in future movies. The thing that more people have had problems with, I didn't have so much because I liked the performance, but like they're introducing the character of Ironheart in it as well.
And
I think the new thing with these Marvel movies is let's introduce a character that's going to then have their own thing as a supporting character in a established thing. And I understand the thinking about that, especially when it's these characters that have less general name recognition. But if you look back at like Guardians of the Galaxy, like they just introduced them in their own movie, gave them their own time, and just trusted that the thing is, if it's a good enough movie, then people will love the characters by the end of it.
I'm going to go back even farther, Dan. If you go back to every single movie before Iron Man, almost every single movie introduced new characters in that movie, got the audience to care about them,
exactly,
and then told a story with them. Like, the idea that you need to introduce, especially now that the Marvel Universe is such a brand, you can just release a Marvel movie, and I don't think you need to do it interlocking jigsaw style. But that it's the thing I've talked about before that I'm always amazed about. The original Star Wars is like when Star Wars A New Hope came out, and it was just called Star Wars. They didn't call it A New Hope because they didn't know they were going to make...
There weren't like annoying nerds.
Exactly. Well, there were annoying nerds, but they're talking about Star Trek. And why isn't it on the air anymore? We only have the same three seasons or whatever to look over and over again. When that movie came out, it's not like people were like, oh, great, the new Luke Skywalker movie is out, or like the new Han Solo movie. They're just like, what is this movie? And the characters got introduced to you, and within 2 hours, you're like, I love these characters. I hope that they're able to defeat the Empire, and then I hope there's a ton more of these movies, and then that they kind of lose sight of what the movies were about, and then they kind of become offensive at a certain point, just in the way they deal with the audience and with our love for the characters, and then that a bigger company buys this property and then makes too much of it, and it proliferates like a cancer, Star Wars metastasizes until it becomes unpleasant. I can't wait, but...
Eventually they'll make a TV show that everybody seems to universally like. So it's all worth it, you know.
But the magic of that movie is that is just a movie that tells a story and you love it. And Marvel could be doing more of that, especially now that they have the audience's buy-in that they like Marvel stuff. But I agree, like Guardians of the Galaxy, that's the smartest thing about that is that even though at the end of that Thor movie, they did do that thing where they go to the collector for some reason. Guardians of the Galaxy, there's like, hey, let's introduce these characters. They're fun. Let's have an adventure. Okay, the adventure's over. Goodbye. And that's a nice way to do movies. You don't need to. So I would say if you're having here's the ultimate thing. If you're finding the Marvel movies confusing and complicated and you're having trouble keeping track of who's who in them, there's thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other movies that you can watch stand on their own.
You don't have
to watch them.
If you're having trouble, remind yourself, it doesn't matter.
I had a conversation with John Hodgman recently where he was like, you don't have to watch Ms. Marvel. It's fun, but it's not essential. And I was like, John, none of them are essential. we can live without any of them. And so I think what will fix the Marvel movies is if the audience starts to understand they don't need to service the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they kind of say, well, I'll come back and watch some of these when you get back to the level of kind of like excitement and thinking about it and thoughtfulness and care that you put into the first, two, maybe three phases of this thing, or maybe two. What phase are they on now? Is it phase four that they're in, or
I don't know.
None of it makes any sense.
One of them.
It doesn't make any
sense. The phases are made up.
Yeah, that's true. The phases are made up. It's all made up.
Yeah, well, I know.
It is all made up. Even the good ones are made up, Dan. Yeah, they're not based on a true story. And even reality is a story that we write day by day. I think if you break yourself out of the prison of feeling like, oh, I owe it to see all these things. One of the greatest decisions I ever made in my life was when I didn't go see Man of Steel in the theaters because I was like, I've got to go see this movie, but I know I'm not going to like it. And I was like, wait a minute, I don't have to go see this movie. If I know I'm not going to like something, or even that there's something I'm going to like more than this, why don't I do that instead? And I never looked back, and I never saw Man of Steel. And just knowing how much Stewart didn't like it has been a joy forever.
No, it is true. Like, to break it out of just this, like, I think that as a human being, sometimes I get trapped in ruts where I'm doing things without really examining why. Like, if there's a thing that you're thinking you're dreading or isn't giving you the joy that you think it should, you know, you can take a break from it, maybe come back later. Your passion,
if you want to,
might reignite, but you don't have to. Do something else. Do something
even
that
this
you
podcast
enjoy. You should probably keep your membership.
Keep on that. In fact, pay more. But I feel like there's a number of things about being a nerd that used to be kind of badges of honor and have now, when nerds were outsiders, and now they have infected society at large. Superiority complexes, resentment of other people, anger at feeling left out of stuff, even when you're at the center of culture. And I think one of the things that's infected modern culture is completism. As a nerd, I always feel the urge to, like, I like this author, I better read every single book they've ever written. I like this movie, I better watch every single movie in the series or every single episode of this TV show. And I think if we can break the idea that completism is good or a virtue or even necessary, and we can just treat entertainment as stuff that we can dip into whenever we want, then media will be healthier in general.
One thing that my therapist told me that I found very helpful was she said, just ask yourself, what is going to make me happy today? Like, and that's like a powerful idea. Like, you don't have to, you know, construct these plans and like be trapped by what you think is necessary. Like, sure, obviously do the things you need to do to live and be responsible, but also think about today and what will make you happy. Don't feel like a weird obligation about your entertainments, your free time.
Yeah. Because if you do, you might make a bad decision and suddenly end up 15 years later watching the animated Marmaduke when you could be watching something that would bring you happiness.
Yeah.
And instead, you're just trying to shield your children from Pete Davidson farting and shitting in a trophy.
I mean, to be clear, it's not Pete Davidson shitting in a trophy. What
they didn't
mocap
that shit?
I have to assume that happens in his Judd Apatow movie.
Yeah. Speaking of Judd Apatow, and the reason that this is a connection will come to light later. Let's talk about recommendations, movies that we kind of like
I love that you're like, speaking of Judd Apatow, now let me put that segue on hold. And
well, I just want to clarify ahead of time, like to prevent you from jumping on me as you are wont to do, to be like, that has nothing to do with Judd Apatow.
No, but I know exactly. I think I know exactly what you're getting at. Because of a conversation we had earlier outside of this podcast.
That's true. Recommendations, movies that we liked that actually might be worth your time and perhaps your movie-going dollar. I saw The Fabelmans recently, and I saw it at a Guild screening where Tony Kushner and Steven Spielberg were there being interviewed by Judd Apatow as the moderator for the Q&A. I will get back to that
Elliot's
in a second.
Favorite filmmakers.
Moving down to Judd Apatow. Won't you take me to Judd Apatow? Won't you take me to Judd Apatow? It's a town that's roughly 20 minutes too long.
I really liked The Fabelmans. I was kind of a little leery of it because sometimes movies about
Dennis
the
Leary.
Magic of the movies.
You don't like magic of cinema, huh?
Magic of cinema movies can be a little self-congratulatory and schmaltzy. And
you're like, cinema paradiso? More like cinema cinema paradickish.
I mean, there are
zero stars, thumbs down.
There are a lot of wonderful movies about movies, but it also can be a license to...
Singing in the Rain? More like stinking
indulge.
In the Rain.
Donnie Darko? More like Donnie Dorko.
I think,
well, how is Donnie Darko's not exactly a movie about the
magic movies. I think you understand
what
I'm saying. You're like making fun of me, but I think you know exactly what I'm talking about. And Spielberg, who is a filmmaker of great skill and who's made many wonderful films, also can indulge his sentimental side, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Cinema mental side.
Mm-hmm. I've seen Minority Report.
It's most sentimental film.
What a sentimental movie.
But I also think that Spielberg is a filmmaker that, in a weird way, like Audrey brought this up recently, and I think she's right, that like he's become so big, he's circled around to being like underrated in a way where people are like dismissive of him because he's, you know, the great crowd pleaser or whatever. I mean, even though he's done like a lot weirder stuff in the latter half of his
career. I think it's a combination of him becoming the establishment favorite. I think you're right. Once someone becomes universally acclaimed, then there's a backlash against them. Much as Martin Scorsese has been backlashed now for daring to have an opinion about movies that people on the internet don't like. That it's, how dare this man who's dedicated his life to cinema, how dare he have an opinion?
Not only his own movies, but like world cinema and getting in front of people.
And preserving old cinema. There's a reason that we have a viewable copy of Vertigo, and it's in large part because of his efforts.
I'm
know?
Sorry. How many of Martin Scorsese's movies have a Deadpool in them? Thank you.
Good true. Point.
Case
Good
closed.
Point. Almost none of them. Yeah. But that's, and also that Steven Spielberg in the latter half of his career he's still an incredibly prolific filmmaker, and his movies are not always at the high average that he achieved.
Yeah.
I think that's why people start to underrate him.
Yes. Yeah. But that being said, this was probably my favorite movie of his, going back to at least Lincoln, maybe earlier, maybe Catch Me If You Can. I really enjoyed it. And it is far more unsparing than you would expect. Like the trailers make it like focus on the magic of cinema schmaltz, but it is much more actually kind of a clear-eyed excavation of some of the more painful moments in his upbringing, and I kind of admired how honest it was, how open-hearted it was to a bunch of like flawed people from his youth, including his parents, primarily his parents. I liked it quite a bit, and I circle back around to Judd Apatow. I enjoyed the part in the Q&A where Tony Kushner was talking about how he was worried that Seth Rogen was going to come in. You know, he's a supporting actor in the movie. He was going to come in. He was going to do a bunch of improv because, you know, Tony Kushner is a writer, a very respected writer, Angels in America, many other things. He was like, oh, Seth Rogen's going to come in and improvise all over it. And Seth came in and was like, oh, this is great. I can do it as written. I don't have to I don't have to make it funny. Like, it's a great script as written. And I'm like, Judd Apatow is right there on the stage, man.
Yeah, what a slap in the face.
But to Judd Apatow's...
I'm used to being presented pages of shit that I have to put a gloss on.
Well, to Apatow's credit, he immediately jumped in and was like, yeah, that's the use of my shit.
Yeah.
Like, Seth will make Apatow, this funny.
But. For all the things that I feel like I don't love Judd Apatow's work, but I feel like he's never been a guy who's going to put on airs and be like, I'm just as good as Tony Kushner, the author of Angels in America.
He seems like a very good-spirited...
I'm just as good as the man who made E.T., you know.
Yeah, he was a very good moderator. It was a fun time, and the movie's great. So go out and see it.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I am going to recommend what is currently my favorite movie of the year. I'm going to recommend Bones and All... the new Luca Guadagnino movie, and you know me, I'm a big Luca stan. I love all his movies. I'm a super freak for it. I would devour
them.
You're
a real guano.
Yep.
You watched Luca, the Pixar movie, under the misapprehension. That it was.
Daring. I'm like, is that Tilda Swinton in makeup? What's going on?
How did they make her look like a CGI character? It's astounding.
She's incredible. Bones and All is kind of like an outsider love story. Set in the 80s, where these two kids who just happen to be cannibals managed to find some connection. And
are they fine and young?
They are fine and young. One of them is Timothy Chalamet. And
doesn't get finer or younger for the time being. He will get old eventually.
It is a beautiful movie. It is a fucking gross movie. And it's also a super sad movie. I read an interview with Luca Guadagnino over at Film Freak Central, where the interviewer Walter Chaw described Luca Guadagnino's movies as having a desperate romanticism. And I think this movie totally exemplifies that, this like yearning for connection. And it uses the scenery and kind of backdrop of the American Midwest as kind of like a perfect palette for this. And it's great. I found it very moving. There's also a very unexpected but very thematically appropriate sequence where Timothée Chalamet dances around to the song Lick It Up by Kiss, which it was very welcome. I love it. It's great.
And speaking of late period Spielberg, Mark Rylance is in it.
Mark Rylance is incredible in it.
Yeah, always good.
And Mark Rylance is an incredible actor. Oh, man, it's great. Two thumbs up.
Elliot, your turn.
Hey guys, what would you do if a life-changing amount of cash literally fell into your lap one night? Would you become so determined to hold on to it that you'd embark on a trail of destruction?
Is he recommending the Brewster's fucking Millions?
Blank check.
That's the choice Elizabeth Scott makes in Too Late for Tears, a 1949 film noir directed by Byron Haskin and written by Roy Huggins, creator of The Rockford Files, Maverick, and The Fugitive. Elizabeth's Jane Palmer is hell-bent on achieving the post-war ideal of financial security, and she doesn't care who she has to kill or kiss to get it. But is this miracle money merely a harbinger of her own doom? It's a film noir, so... probably, but find out for sure by watching the enjoyably tawdry Too Late for Tears, currently streaming on Tubi.
Wow, that was nice and tight. Thanks.
Yeah, that was nice and tight. Did you write that one down?
My long
maybe. Maybe I wrote it down ahead of time because I know I can get pretty rambly and loose.
Uh-huh.
Well,
much like what Marmaduke put into that trophy, sometimes my recommendations can get too rambly and loose.
That's fair. Yeah.
This has been great. Before we go, I want to mention yet again, in case people skip over the stuff in the middle where our promos, Stuart.
Yeah, we're doing a Twitch stream, me and Dan, with special guest Elliot, hopefully. We're going to do a Twitch stream over at my channel, Stuart Wellington, on December 14th. It's a Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we're going to be cooking up a storm, having some drinks, answering questions, goofing around. Please join us.
And I also wanted to remind people that the Sexy Xenomorph contest is still going on. That is to do a music video for the song Sexy Xenomorph by our producer, Alex Smith, and the three of us.
Song of the fall.
The contest rules are available on the website under the Munsters episode and show notes. I'll try and put them also separately on a blog section as well. If you want to be part of that, get your entry in, put it on YouTube, email us about it before New Year's. Again, all the rules are on the website. And I want to thank our network, Maximum Fun. Go over to MaximumFun.org. Look at all the great podcasts they have there. And then once you're done looking at them, listen to one of them. Mm-hmm. Also, thank you.
It's more of an audio medium.
More of an audio thing, but, you know.
Yeah.
And then I also wanted to thank Alex Smith, the aforementioned Alex Smith, who did Sexy Xenomorph, but more importantly, for us, at least, is our great producer and puts all this stuff together.
And he's like a good friend of mine. He was my best man at my wedding, Dan.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying for the entity, the Flophouse. That's how listeners know him. But anyway, for the Flophouse, I've been Dan McCoy.
Hey, I'm Stuart Wellington.
And I'm Ellie Kalin.
See ya.
Rough, rough.
Way to tie it together. So how about, guys, how about if I just drop in and I'm not there the whole time?
He'll be like, David Bowie dropping by to sing Little Drummer Boy?
Exactly. And that's what I'll do.
What a terrible song that is. I mean, their version is probably the one I like the best, but it's not a good song. Anyway.
Just because someone has no gifts to bring, Dan is not interested in their song.
Yeah.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.